The situation in Syria and the Middle East over the last decade has been getting more aggressive and dangerous for the civilians that live there. Last week's vote for more military action has seen student opinion divided, with many struggling to understand what the right course of action is. In light of the recent events, last week at the University of Nottingham, students were invited to witness a varsity debate hosted by Voice Your Rights. The motion proposed to Britain and other high-income countries was to allow an open border policy for both refugees and migrants. We at URN sent Harry to investigate.
Public opinion in democracies is incredibly important, and why this motion is harmful to the foreign policies of more economically developed countries, and also is bad for refugees and migrants that travel to those countries. Under the status quo, there is already a public concern about immigration. Look at the USA reaction to Paris by several states saying they will not take Syrian refugees. Look at public opinion in the UK at the moment. A lot of these concerns centre around things like pressure on services, housing and jobs. And these problems will be exacerbated by an open border policy. You also then have political opposition to this from the popular right, which is on the rise in Europe. See Britain First, the National Front, Golden Dawn. Because the public opinion says, we've opened our borders, why on earth should we spend any of our money doing anything else? What more do they want?
With the recent airstrikes in Syria, countries like the UK now have a direct moral responsibility for the people we affect there.
This notion that Britain is full. 93% of the UK is not urban. We can look at Northern Scotland, many parts of England. We are still not a very congested country. We still have a lot of space to fit these people. Even urban areas, 50% of urban areas are parkland, farmland. We still have a lot of places where we could build houses, and the notion that we are full is simply not true. Only 7% of immigrants go on to claim benefits, so you are more likely to claim benefits if you are in fact not an immigrant. Also, the NHS, there's a kind of a lack of figures on this. Some say it costs $2 billion for immigrants to use the NHS, but some say it costs $50 million, which is only 0.1% of the overall budget of the NHS. They do not have a very vast effect. On the economy, there's lots of stats. There's one interesting one conducted by University College London. It found that immigration contributed $5 billion in taxes more than what they took out in benefits. They put $5 billion into the economy. Sure, there are some people who are afraid of the multicultural Britain. Despite what I've already said, that there's no need to be afraid, but we should not let their fears of seeing more Syrian products in their supermarkets stop us saving thousands and thousands of lives of people in the Middle East. We should instead embrace and tolerate an open-minded and caring side of ourselves and continue building a society we can all be proud to live in.
Maybe we should care a bit more about a refugee child or a pregnant woman or an 80-year-old man than we should a 30-year-old who can largely fend for himself. So that's the first distinction we need to make in this debate, and we need to ask the question, who does this policy help? Does this policy help the Syrian child? Does it help the refugee pregnant woman? Does it help the frail old man? Or does it help the people, no thank you, does it help the people who are most able to make this journey? And what I'm saying is, they are fleeing a war, and they see a war, and they say, I've just got to get as far away from that damn war as I possibly can. And subsequently, they are making this decision and putting their lives, the lives of children, the lives of elderly people who have just been turfed out of their home of 60 years. They just had to walk 4 days across the Syrian desert just to get to the sea. What you are saying with this policy is you are saying that you are incentivizing them, right, to go and make that journey. We don't think that's okay, because we think that that is going to end up with far more Syrian children face down in the sea off the coast of Greece because they are just scared and just trying to get away.
What you have just heard were extracts of the main arguments given by both sides. However, the judges, Dr. Hyde and Professor Kritikosis, had some questions for both teams.
So my question to NTU is, you raised this point about the direct moral responsibility to take on refugees because of bombing that's taking place. What does that mean? Does that mean that there would be a different moral responsibility this morning if the House of Commons voted another way last night?
No, I think we had a moral responsibility even if we didn't.
Yeah, even if we didn't, but
I think it maybe it's more. If anything, it's just increased.
But why wouldn't you advocate bombing earlier so that you could help them quicker?
If you're so inclined to grant it, then you can also grant, I said, you can also grant that this government now has a responsibility, because once you engage in the military conflict, such as we are, you then have a responsibility to those people after the conflict is done, to help them in some regard. And one way of helping them is taking in refugees.
So if you just expand on that point about there would be a moral responsibility without bombing.
If anything, it is just increased. And our argument is that we're doing it to help those people, so why do we think that bombing them is helping them when not taking them into our own country is not helping them?
Speech in opposition, where there was an attempt to sort of categorise refugees as what refugees who are more in need and less in need. Isn't it the case that people who are refugees are almost by definition people in need, people in need of refuge, people in need of help? And is it really helpful to be putting these vulnerable people into categories and saying you're more in need than this person, you're more in need of this refuge that we may want to give you?
No, not at all. Because if we went to a refugee camp in Jordan and the British government was saying, okay, so we can take 1,000 refugees as a totally arbitrary figure, would they just select 1,000 refugees at random? No, they probably wouldn't. They'd probably take those who need the most help. So if you accept that logic, then you should accept the logic that any policy which any government puts into place should be aimed at helping those who need help the most. And I think it's totally legitimate to say that children need help more than a 30-year-old fit man who's more than capable of making that journey. If that picture of the child face down in the surf were a picture of a 30-year-old man face down in the surf, I don't think it would have had the same impact.
The question to the opposition follows on from my fellow judge's comments, which is that I've always understood the Refugee Convention, and since you want to focus exclusively on the issue of refugees, I'm happy to do that. The Refugee Convention is always about protecting human rights. And listening to both of your presentations, it seems that we have to help some refugees, according to the first speaker, and we have to help particular refugees with regard to the other speaker. So the question is, how are you turning the Refugee Convention, which is one of the beacons of the human rights movement, into a cause for discrimination? Because according to both of you, we have to discriminate between different types of refugees. That's completely against human rights, and it's voicing against rights, not voicing for rights.
You are of interest to pose. So if we... No, I don't have that argument at all. Because would you... Okay, so I'm an economist, right? So we can put monetary value on life if you wanted to. I would argue that I care somewhat more about a child who is on a boat, who is scared, who has maybe lost his family. I should care about that child more than I should care about a 30-year-old man who can fend for himself. I don't think human rights come into that. I think that is a question of, we have a policy, and we have a certain amount of resources, we have a certain amount of time and energy that we can dedicate to this. Do we just have some free-for-all, or do we target it to people who need help the most? It's not about who has more rights, it's about who needs more help.
And also, going on from that, what we're arguing is that this policy inherently is discriminatory, because there are only a certain number of people who are actually capable of making the perilous journey. Under this motion, you incentivise everybody to try and get to MEDC, rather than, for example, going to, like, the Syrian refugee, go to Jordan, which, as Brand told you, may actually be more suitable because they're closer to return after the conflict, similarities of language, culture and religion. Under this policy, you incentivise everybody to try to get to MEDC, often crossing the Mediterranean. This means that actually it is discriminatory, because there are certain groups of people who can do that much more easily than others. For example, being, you know, like a 30-year-old man by on a boat for several days without food than a small child can. So this policy is actually inherently discriminatory, and we are the side that is better for all refugees because we give them the true choice to go where is best for them.
So that was the judges' views on the issues raised, but what did you, the public, think?
Because, you know, people in the UK, they read the Daily Mail, they read the Sun, so refugees or immigrants are going to come to this country, are going to come to a more hostile environment, not going to be liked, and whatnot. So what I get from your argument there is, are you saying that we as British people, instead of tackling xenophobia, we try and appease xenophobes and not help these people?
That's not at all what we're saying. We're not saying that, you know, some people read the Daily Mail, therefore we should close our borders. What we're saying is that public opinion is really important in democracies, which all MEDCs are. If we completely ignore popular opinion by opening borders, which very, very few people want to do, whether or not they are right-wing, then you actually make more people, like xenophobic if you want, or anti-refugee, people think of them as a strain on the services, they blame them for the austerity. This then means that the government has less democratic mandate to do nice foreign aid things like help rebuild Syria or Libya, because the popular opinion is, well, haven't we done enough? We've opened our borders, why should we do anything else?
But do you not also agree, though, that in the 1950s there was, again, a lot of anti-immigration sentiment, and we got through that period, we became a stronger country because of it, and we became a more multicultural, integrated society because of it. And then in 2004, 2005, again, there was a lot of Eastern European migrants coming over, and again, Daily Mail was against that as well, obviously. So, as we see in the past, there is right-wing sentiment at the time, but we get over that, we get through it, and we become a stronger country afterwards. And who's to say that after we accept these immigrants, we won't become a stronger country again?
Do you think in communities, certain communities, Polish people are not discriminated against? Like, I don't know what the evidence in your analysis there is. We're not pandering to xenophobes. What we're doing is what is best by the Syrian refugees. We want to help them. We want to make their lives as easy as we possibly can. And you can call it pandering to xenophobes if you want to. Right? You can't change human nature. And there is only a certain... people see their communities changing at speed, which they are struggling to come to terms with. If that's something which is happening very quickly, if public opinion is where it is and is not just going to change overnight, in fact is going to get more progressive, more right-wing overnight as a result of your policy, then that's going to make refugees' lives worse. I don't see why you want to take this principle stance to, like, smash the Daily Mail, but if you're doing that on the backs of refugees who are going to discriminate against, I don't think that's a good idea.
And so basically you talk of a democratic society and public opinion. If you see that even that's a tangible idea, you see that public opinion said do not go to Syria, they went through with it, do not go to Afghanistan, don't go to Iraq and Iran, it happened. And let's be honest, with public opinion, once again, it's based on certain people's opinion and agendas. That happens with the government, it's happened so many times over. And in relation to the particular circumstances, you said that the 30-year-old would be able to defend himself. I'm sorry, but he's not an Iron Man. If a gun is pointed at him, military weapons, he will not be able to defend against that. And that's very harsh to say that you're 30, you're going to be stranded, you stay there. That's a very, unjust perception. And you said basically in relation to having a system in place that certain people meet the criteria and certain people don't. How would you govern that? How would you keep it just and proportionate?
For example, invading various different places. This is true, this is not necessarily a good thing that we are defending, but the difference in that is that I don't see the effects when the government starts doing airstrikes on Syria. I do see the effects when the government hasn't opened your policy. Then people are inherently care about what is happening in their hometown, in their own backyard, and this means that actually when you have an open door policy, more people become anti-refugee. Because they see the effect that it has on them. It does matter what people think in a democracy, because the government wants votes. A government is inherently short-termist in that, because they want to be re-elected in 5 years' time. This means that when the people say, what more, why should then the government has no incentive to implement good foreign policy because they will not win votes from it and they will probably lose votes from it. And then you say, like, well, this 30-year-old man, he's still going to die if he gets shot. Yes, but our alternative isn't let's keep all of the Syrians in Syria, right? This is, we're not saying we're going to have a closed-door policy and we're going to keep all the refugees where, where they are. Our policy is you continue, is the status quo, right? So you continue to have people coming into MEDCs, but under a quota, which means that they can easier integrate, which means that there's not as much anti-refugee sentiment. So you still get good foreign policy. You still get aid going to Jordan to help with their refugee camps. And actually, it's probably better for the refugee to go, like, for many reasons, it's better for a refugee to go to a neighbouring country than make a parent's journey.
Okay, so what about the procedural element, because you did not address that? Where, how do you keep it just? How do you keep it proportionate? Because then, once again, it's subjective.
Since Germany had taken in 800,000 migrants, the Pegida rallies have flared up again and almost doubled in size. How would you explain that proposition?
As I said in my speech, there are obviously some people who are against immigration. We can see people voting for UKIP, people voting for BNP. I'm not denying that there's people who are against immigration. However, as I said, I think they should not be able to set the agenda of an entire country, and that instead, as I said, we are actively saving lives, thousands of lives, and we should remember that when we are accepting these migrants, and that we should, like, take on our caring side and do what is best for them.
If we make all more developing countries like have adopt this policy, then I think you'll see a sort of a more even distribution amongst those countries of refugees and migrants.
Opposition seems to be trying to take the moral high ground in this. You should realise that what they're actually doing is that they are leaving people to die in Syria and on the streets of Turkey. That's what they are doing by, like, accepting more migrants. So they're saying, oh, we're trying to help the most vulnerable, we're trying to help these people. They're not. They're just leaving them in that country to die.
The final vote in the form of a landslide victory was the motion of Britain and others having open borders. Yet before Harry left, he got a more detailed opinion from both judges on how students can understand this issue further.
Issues, particularly since you're dealing with refugees, is the issue of the Refugee Convention of 1951, and I think that maybe having copies of that displayed so people can just be conscious of the fact, because the motion this evening worked with the assumption that this was an open debate. There are sort of no curtailments on what the government can and cannot do, and I think that if we look at what the Refugee Convention says, it's very clear. It answers a lot of the questions that were actually mooted tonight as options for the government.
Do you think that the international community, the government and also the public have pressurised the government into doing something that they don't want to do and the majority of the public now don't want to do but have to be seen to doing something for the state's welfare and benefit?
I mean, there may be an element of that, and governments have constantly got to respond to sort of public demand. They're very conscious of what publics are saying, and you saw that in the debate this evening where, you know, we were constantly reminded of the readership of the Daily Mail. But we have to also remember that governments are there to lead, they're not there to follow. Daily Mail has numerous campaigns that it has going, that it supports, and the government has really got to be very conscious of the fact that it is leading in terms of some of the moral problems and challenges of our time.
The more sort of debate and discussion that we have amongst people, students, the wider community that sort of engages with these issues, the better that we're going to be informed and the better that we're going to be able to deal with these things going forward. If indeed it is the case, as was argued in this debate, that the public makes a difference to what we should and could do, a better informed public, a public that's more engaged with these issues, is going to be a public that leads to better public policy outcomes. And I think students can play a really important role in that.
Give a bit of time to stop the clock and listen to actually what is going on, rather than just have news feed dripped to you minute by minute of every day.
Thank you.
Our thanks again to Professor Kritikosis and Dr. Hyde of the University Law School for both judging the debate and lending their own insight into the problem facing us all. To both the debating teams from Nottingham and from Trent for debating such a difficult topic. And lastly, thanks must go to the organisers for the event, Voice Your Rights.
This is URN The Pulse.
So that was a very, very emotive debate. I was very pleased actually to go and watch it. I had varying opinions on what was brought up, and I'm now going to put these opinions to the rest of the group here. So obviously Trent had the stronger argument, and public opinion had the stronger argument. But some of the things that Uniov did bring up were valid in certain ways. So, for example, even though I didn't agree with their idea of categorisation, and it was one of the points that the judges marked them heavily down on, Britain as a country, we can't take everyone. So there is, even though, like, when you're talking to students, and they probably didn't go about it the right way, sort of saying to students, oh, we'll only take sort of the old men, the young children, and the sort of the sick and the elderly and the young, basically, wasn't the right way to go about it, I think. But they do have a point. We do have a duty of care to those that are less fortunate than the fit and able, but not in this sense. They framed it badly, saying, with the whole sort of going across the sea, if they want to get to an MEDC, everyone will have to go across the sea. So that was a point that I thought was... I sort of agreed, but disagreed at the same time. Also, the people proposing, so Trent were proposing to have open borders, this idea about moral responsibility, their argument was slightly flawed in the sense that they didn't get across the fact that we had a moral responsibility before we started the airstrikes, and that is something that they didn't get across, and I thought maybe that would sway the public slightly more, the fact that their argument almost sounded as if they themselves, because they're saying we now have a bigger moral responsibility, it's almost like they feel guilty, and guilt is not really, that doesn't make us sort of increase our moral responsibility. We should already have that bigger sense of moral responsibility because we are a leading country in Western society. There were other ones sort of. Wasn't mentioned in the clip, but the opposition for sort of not having open borders was that we're giving them hope when there is none because they have to make this perilous journey. We're giving them an incentive to get there. So their argument of taking as many people to Jordan and other surrounding countries means that they don't have to make the perilous journey, means that they don't have to have small children on boats that are rickety and end up sinking and will hopefully would stop small children getting washed up on the coast of Greece, is true in that sense. We should be saying, look, you don't have to make this trip all the way to the UK, all the way to France, all the way to Germany, when we have set up stations for you in and around where you live. Obviously, they'll argue it's not far enough. It's not far enough away, which is what the opposition to Uniov argued. It's not far enough. They want to just get as far away as possible. But there has to be sort of a sense where, okay, we can take this many people and the rest of you. We're not abandoning you, but we are placing you somewhere where we can at least help more easily. Yes, you can't get to the UK, and we don't want you to make the perilous journey, but do try and get to somewhere where we can at least help you to bring aid, medication, doctors, where we can look after you to the best of our ability, be that protection with armed forces in and around the camps, or just far enough away from the conflict and the shelling.
But I don't know. I think the thing is, like, the UK as a country is not massively popular for refugees to come to it anyway. Like, if you look at Germany has asylum seekers. Germany had 202,815 202,000, yeah, 815 like requests for asylum. We only had 31,000. So it's the fact that we're making such a massive deal out of something, which I don't think we don't have as big a problem as other countries such as Germany. France has got way more than us, and we're the country not, making the fuss.
But yeah, would you not argue that's because Germany, they had an open border system, and then they have had to close to an extent,
well, no,
close
it's
their
more
borders.
Than that. It's the fact it's both Germany and France. Germany, Merkel specifically said refugees welcome. There was, you know, hundreds of things through the street. Football teams wore banners. Everything else. France is sort of a difficult one because people come into Italy and then look to move up through the Alps into northern European countries, and then either stay at France or get stuck in France when moving on to Britain. I think that the Germany statistics are a bit difficult to use in like a quantified basis because of the actions that they took when it came to their policy.
But I mean, also there's the fact that they brought up in the speech for sort of opposing this open border policy the pressure that it could put on jobs, it could put on housing, it could put on places like the NHS and the benefits. And going to what James said about sort of the fact that the amount of asylum seekers, Britain's policy on asylum seekers means it takes about around 6 months to get the paperwork through. And if you think you have a huge influx, that was the issue, I think, the fact that there was a huge mass exodus, and that is where why Germany sort of, they were all pleased they arrived when the first, say, 100,000 arrived, or and then when more and more started arrived, and it came to the point that they weren't going to stop and they were just going to spread out through Europe. The idea that there needs to be a system of control, and that is the problem that Europe is facing at the moment. We don't have a system of control.
Well, I think I get the point that you're saying, sort of, we can't just sort of just like let people come in as they want. But the fact that you said that it will put pressure on like housing and the economy, like I think it was a point that Trent said that actually, if you look at immigrants, they actually put £5 billion into the economy. They actually are less likely to claim benefits than people who are already UK nationals. And in addition, like the urban landscape of the UK is only 10.6%. Only 10.6% of the country has actually been built upon. So when people say we don't have room for refugees, it's absolute rubbish, because we do.
But there's also the issue that they brought up in the debate. It was a bit of a weaker one from Uni's point of view, which was that Britain needs to sort, in a way, it's got issues at home already without adding the issue of where to place refugees.
But you can't argue that just because we have issues at home, we can't look and help other people. At the end of the day, we're a first world country and we have a moral responsibility to people who are fleeing their country because there's these atrocities going on. We can't say, yeah, but we've got a bit of problem with the economy at the moment, so not going to let you in. Like, that's not what we can do.
But it's also the fact that the argument of the government is putting, look, we've given you that, we've attempted to sort of alleviate your problems by giving you refugee sort of camps in Jordan and around that area where we are sending aid, we are sending relief. So,
but at the end of the day, Harry, they're refugee camps. They're not homes. These people want places to go. They want places to live and have livelihoods. They don't want to be stuck in a camp.
Yeah, but it's surely safer for them to go there than try and cross this where it is safer, but maybe not as safe as they would be in Britain, and not as not where they exactly want to go. But at least there, they don't have to. Young women, sort of pregnant young women, sort of young boys, young children, don't have to cross the Mediterranean in boats that take
It's easy for us to say, sitting here in a cushy studio in Nottingham. We're not there. We've not got that fear of knowing that at any point you could be shot at or run away from. And it's just like the fact that I can understand why they would want to get as far away as humanly possible, and why a camp in like just over the border might not be sufficient for these people to feel safe.
As well, there's no telling how long this is going to be. These refugees could be sat in a camp for upwards of 5 years when it comes to the end of it.
And is that also, but surely from the public's point of view, that could be what what the public are scared about, in the sense that they've stayed so long in Britain, they may not want to leave, which is fine if we end up building on the 90% of sort of unurban areas we've got left in Britain. But you've got to think, Britain itself has a rising population as well. We will struggle in the near future if we don't express to these people, yes, you can stay for now, but when the conflict dies down,
immigration is contributing $5 billion to the economy a year as it stands. If we say, oh, the war's over now, off you go. Not off you go.
I mean, as I said, we have a moral responsibility to sort of help rebuild and things. So we wouldn't sort of say off you go. I mean, there was an argument from the lecturers, once they're in the country, how far do we go to help them? Once they're in, if we have an open border policy, how far do you think we should go?
Well, I don't know who it was, but I'm not saying this is 100% feasible, but I think it was one of the Home Secretaries or Shadow Home Secretary, I can't remember it was, who said, like, if every family took in, like, one refugee, or if every derelict home was made for a refugee to, like, live in, we could literally take in thousands, thousands, thousands more than David Cameron says that we are going to take in. And I think once they're in, obviously, we can't just sort of leave them on their own, just be like, right, okay, you're in now, get a job off your own back, even though you can't speak a word of English and all of this. But yeah, I think there should be support for them, obviously, like, to an extent. At the end of the day, like, we can't pour in all this money, but we should help them when they're here as well.
Oh no, we should definitely, like, help them when they're here. And if it means sort of a slow integration, all I feel is that there needs to be a system of a better system. The system we have at the moment of sort of processing them, getting them to places where they can relax and can, even if it is in our country or not in our country, places where they can go, the housing we can give them, getting them on sort of the benefits and then getting them a job in Britain. There needs to be a better plan put forward by the government. And the reason the government has yet to say, I think we will take more refugees, is because they don't have a concrete plan. And the reason they don't have a concrete plan is because they have to deal with both sides of the public. It's a public that want an open border system and public that really don't. They've always got to play to both sides, because, as was said in the debate, they are a short-term investment. In 5 years' time, the Conservatives and David Cameron may not be in power. So any sort of policies they put on, the next government may say, no, we're changing that completely.
I think that you're simplifying the issue with the government when it comes to their plans on refugees. It's far more than pandering to both sides of this apparently line drawn in the political sand. I think that you've got to consider the fact that David Cameron has promised an EU referendum, and he has to fight to stay in the European Union. That's what he wants. He's got to make sure he doesn't lose a huge amount of the people who vote for him to UKIP because of his actions abroad. And he's got to make sure, quite simply, that with this knock-on effect of taking refugees in, that he doesn't destabilise his own referendum, which he's hopefully set up for us to remain in the EU. I don't think you can simply, you know, simply just say, oh, it's because, you know, they have to tell this side and that side. Mm.
Oh yeah, no, obviously, but, like, there's also the fact that we have, like they mentioned in the debate, we have, as Britain as a whole, has a moral responsibility. Now, one of the judges said, since we started bombing Syria, should our moral sort of obligation to them go up? So if the answer was yes, and from considering the way that the vote ended with the sort of Trent winning, and that we should have an open border system, if the government take that as a yes, why then, there's the argument that we are giving in, we feel guilty, the bombing was the wrong, starting to bomb them was the wrong choice, because we are pushing more people out of their homes. So, I mean, the issue, like, with categorisation and moral responsibility is a balancing act. I don't know if anyone else feels. Is obviously Meg feels slightly different.
Yeah, I just pick up on a couple of points that have been made recently, like the 10% of urban areas in England. in Britain, sorry, if you think about it, refugees aren't going to want to live in the 90%. They're going to want to live in the 10% where they can get a job and be in a city rather than in the middle of nowhere. I think also on the 5 billion impact they have on the economy, would you not rather see that 5 billion spread out among the neighbouring countries where it can help? Because if we actually develop maybe a strategy of let's put all our resources into making sure that these people who are fleeing from the country don't just get set up in a camp in a neighbouring country, they can actually start contributing and setting up a life in these countries rather than just kind of waiting there for nothing. And I think in terms of the categorisation thing, yeah, I thought it was dangerous to start valuing human life over another simply because of one person's needs. But I do see the issue of making sure we spend our resources wisely. And also, I think in terms of the moral obligation, Syria has kind of been used as a political playground for US and Russia over the last few years. Why do we feel a obligation to pick up the pieces from their conflict of arming rebels and whatnot?
The Pulse, the news that matters to you.
So it seems we all have fairly strong views over what the government and Britain as a whole should be doing over the refugee crisis that's currently going on in Syria and sort of filtering in to the West through social media. And that's something I want to quickly bring up before the end, is a point that came through in the Trent's debate was the power that social media has in swaying public opinion. They mentioned the Mail. Come on, it's the Mail. I won't say any more. But do we think that the public opinion is really sort of seen through areas such as TV and through journalism and radio? Because you could argue that the Mail and sort of newspapers as a whole only accounts for sort of maybe 30% of the population of what people actually are saying.
I think that especially tabloids, do have a massive influence over what people think about these kind of things. Because at the end of the day, even if you read it mockingly, even if you read it like, oh, it's absolute rubbish, people do read it. People look at it and think, oh, what's the Mail said about this? Or just even if they're just looking for a ridiculous opinion. And I think it has a massive influence. Like, there's a reason why the people who the Mail has backed for the general election statistically are the party most likely to win, and that has happened year in, year out. People who the Mail has backed have won the election, and there's a reason why this kind of stuff happens, because they do have such a massive influence on British public opinion.
So we rely in a way too much on tabloids and what sort of TV and media in general are saying. And it could be argued also that the government relies too much to find out what public opinion are saying by just looking at the headlines. They don't as much now go and sort of visit their constituents and ask them what they think on the issues.
Well, to an extent, they don't need to visit their constituents anymore. I know my timeline in particular, this last week has been absolutely full of everyone I know giving their opinion on the matter, saying what they think about it. Really, social media is a more efficient way for a government to get the opinion of the public in their area.
But they get the opinion of some of the leading members of in your area. They won't get the opinion of everyone.
But I think that's the point of social media, isn't it? It's the point that if you're Googling a hashtag and you say it's stop Syrian airstrikes or like condoning them, you can look at them and you can be like, well, so and so many people have hashtagged this, so many people have hashtagged that. It's like you can see the proportions. It's everybody. It's not just sort of like the people who are in with the MPs and their constituency. It's everybody making their opinion known.
But you also, surely you lose that sort of consciousness that comes with, or that may come with, sort of choosing a decision. If you look at a stat and go, okay, 70% have condoned the airstrikes in.
But how
Syria.
Would it have not been stats before? Before it just would have been stats, but it would have been stats with people who they've just sort of done a small target market sort of like audience of like 20 people in their constituency. It's effectively the same thing as they would have done before, but except now they're just using the internet as a source instead of just going and like speaking to people in the town.
But they're losing that sense of seeing the passion and emotion behind the people. That if they saw, say, a group of elderly gentlemen passionately sort of and went up to them and spoke to them and asked them, and they said, look, what you're doing is Syria and is wrong, it's equivalent to what Germany did in World War II, for example, with bombing places, then they may stick in their mind more than a statistic of someone saying, yeah, 70% of your constituents.
Well, if that's the case, then social media by far is the better way to do things. If two people have differing opinions, one person's opinion's not more valid than the other in any way. So if an MP is more likely to be swayed by an older gentleman getting really passionate about something, does that disadvantage an 18-year-old who might go up to an MP and say, yeah, let's bomb Syria? That disadvantages the 18-year-old because the opinions are not carrying as much weight as that of the older person.
No, but they've got to understand that social media isn't for everyone. So you've got sort of areas of where people and groups of people that don't use social media. So how will they, if they're not doing these sort of look through towns and doing sort of small groups where they go and talk to people, they won't see the issues.
I don't think they're not doing them. I don't for a minute think that MPs are literally just sitting in front of their computers and being like, this is how I'm going to know what my constituents think. I still think that going round talking to people and sort of getting, even like old people still send letters to their MPs and like stuff like this, and I really don't think that that's gone away at all. I think that they are still doing that, but I'm just thinking that social media and the internet and sort of public media is just another way of getting people's opinions. It's not necessarily going against the idea of sort of public contact and actually going to forums and seeing people like that, but I just think it's something new that's come in, which in any way I think just sort of makes it easier for politicians to know what people are thinking.
I would say from a student point of view as well, I find our social media bubble is very much left wing, in the sense that I remember after the Conservatives won the most recent election, just the amount of stuff on my newsfeed, which was, you know, all sorts of probably not the nicest things to say about the Tories coming through my social media. And I think our perception of the news is really key in that newspapers want black or white debates. They want, you know, it's either this or that. It's either we bomb Syria or we don't. And I think a lot of people, even if they can look at the Daily Mail or maybe the Daily Star and say, oh, you know, we're low rubbish, we still, our perception of the news is still subliminally kind of keyed in by the fact that all the newspapers will be throwing up the debate and picking the sides to that they want to represent, maybe not all the sides that are in the mixture.